Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Dobson, and I represent Mr. Coleman, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue here is whether appellant was denied effective assistance of counsel when counsel failed to understand it was the defense's burden to establish social guest standing to challenge a warrantless search of a home. The record establishes that counsel's performance was objectively unreasonable, and the state appears to concede this.
Would it be prejudicial if we were to agree that the emergency aid exception was established?
It would be harmless if that were the case. It's our position that it didn't apply because the trial court first incorrectly applied the law, and that the factual findings would not have supported the law if it were correctly applied.
Are you going to address that? I mean, I don't want to interrupt your standing argument.
I can go straight to that if you'd prefer.
Okay.
The trial court incorrectly applied State v. Schultz. In that case, the Washington Supreme Court set forth 6 factors to consider when determining whether it was necessary for officers to enter the apartment in order to render aid or assistance. The trial court expressly chose to only consider 4 of the 6 factors urged on by the state to do so. It did not consider factor 4, whether there was an imminent threat of substantial injury to a person, and it did not consider factor 5, whether their officers believed a specific person was in need of immediate help for health or safety.
Well, assuming that the court did not make a finding or a conclusion of law as to imminent harm, are there facts that would support that?
It's our position that not under this record, and certainly not under the findings that were made and procured by the state.
And let me just, so that I'm clear, it's my understanding you didn't challenge the findings.
We challenged the findings to the extent that, I'm sorry, these findings as written are not substantial. We didn't challenge the factual findings. We challenged some of the conclusions of law that meld in with factual findings.
Okay.
So it's not quite as clear. In this case, there were no express findings that there was imminent threat of substantial injury, and there were no express findings that the officers believed Brown was in immediate need of help. And actually, the findings show otherwise. The officers waited here for 15 minutes outside the door to obtain a key. And the reason for this was that they didn't want to incur any property damage on the door. If the officer believed there was an imminent threat of substantial injury, there's no reason to sit outside of a door just because you don't want to damage the lock. Also, if they believe that there was a person here who could be bleeding out or was substantially injured, again, they wouldn't wait outside a door for 15 minutes.
Are there other findings that support your argument that there is no evidence of imminent harm?
Well, it's not any harm, it's imminent harm. There is a finding that says there's potential danger, that the officers believe they needed to stay there because there was potential danger. But potential, when you look it up in the dictionary, only means possible but not yet realized, latent. Imminent means about to occur and impending. So there is the problem here, that not applying the correct legal standard, they didn't procure the right factual findings here, that there was an imminent threat. And because they're waiting outside, I'm not sure they couldn't have in this case. The other factor here, and I did submit a statement of additional authority yesterday, and this is that there's nothing here that established that it would have been impracticable to obtain a warrant. And that's the state's burden when trying to establish this exception. And I cited Tibbles, State versus Tibbles, and State versus Henshaw in the additional authority. Here we have 3 officers securing the residence, and there's only a potential danger, which is contained. If it had been escalated to an imminent danger, then they were prepared for this. And there's nothing indicating why there it was not possible to get a telephonic warrant in this particular situation, where there's only a potential danger and where they have the place secured by three officers. So in the end, the state failed to procure and failed to prove and certainly failed to procure the necessary factual findings that it met its burden under factors 4 and 5.
Would the defendant have the right to be in his mother-in-law's apartment if the protected person under the protection order is also in there?
I think that this situation goes to State v. Jacobs, where it's as if there's wrongful, the state cites that for the proposition that if someone is wrongfully in a location, they can't really establish a legitimate expectation of privacy. Jacobs doesn't apply here because he wasn't found in Tara Brown's apartment. Jacobs hinges on the notion that society's unwilling to recognize a privacy right. And it talks about a burglar in a house or someone in a hotel room via fraud or an ex-husband in a house that after the court has awarded it to a spouse. This is not that situation. This is much murkier. This is a situation.
Does he have a right to be in that apartment if the protected person is there?
He should not remain. The question is, in this situation, when the officers, if she arrived there and he's legitimately there, he should not remain there. But the question is, how quickly did this happen? Did he go upstairs to get his keys, make sure his kids understood while he was leaving, and then?
I understand he went there with her.
Well, that is the facts. Therein is the problem here. Here's the prejudice of the ineffective assistance of counsel. The facts here are from Ms. Matthews. And if I could just take a minute of my time here to finish this.
Sure.
The facts here are from the state offered those comments from Ms. Matthews. There's no finding that she's particularly credible, and the jury ultimately did not believe her. But the problem here is that there were facts available to the defense that he was not in Tara Brown's apartment, that she's just showed up. And Ms. Matthews called the police out of spite. These were not brought into the record because counsel was ineffective in not understanding that it was her burden, the defense's burden, to bring this into the record. So there is the prejudice right there, is that this was available. And if that's the case,
there would have been testimony that the defendant was in the mother-in-law's apartment and then Tara arrived at later.
Absolutely, that is in the record, and that's the problem.
And you can do that on the phone.
I will definitely point that out, and I'll save the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Stephanie Neitlinger on behalf of the state, the respondent in this case. This court should reject Coleman's appeal for two reasons. First, based on the eyewitness report of Tara Brown, that the victim, based on the eyewitness report of Ms. Matthews, that Tara Brown had recently been assaulted at Tara's apartment by Coleman, that this witness was familiar with the significant history of domestic violence perpetrated by Coleman on Tara, and that she had seen Coleman fleeing with Tara to Tara's mother's apartment. That justified the officer's reasonable actions to enter into the apartment to check on the safety of Tara. Second, Coleman cannot prevail on his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel because he cannot establish prejudice. Because even if Patricia Brown had testified at the 3-6 hearing, she would not have established sufficient facts to show that he had standing to contest the entry, and even if the trial court had found standing, as the court correctly had asked opposing counsel, the emergency aid exception applied, so there would be no prejudice. I want to first turn to the emergency aid exception, and specifically factors 4 and 5, which is really the crux of the issue here. The factors 4 and 5 are the meaning of the imminent threat of substantial injury and the person in need of immediate help. Now, while there are not findings or conclusions of law, there are substantial evidence in the record to support those findings. And in Schultz, the Washington State Supreme Court first reiterated the factors from Kinsey and then added three additional factors. And those two included factors 4 and 5. In factor 4, the court had said that they were gleaning those factors from the Court of Appeals cases.
Well, assume that factors 4 and 5 should have been considered and there should have been conclusions of law. What specific findings are you pointing to support those two factors?
I am pointing to the finding that the officers believed they did not know on Clerk's Papers 90, they did not know the extent of injuries to Tara or if she had injuries from the assault.
Are you referring to the 3-6 hearing testimony?
I'm referring to the actual trial court's findings.
Okay.
I can go to the testimony. I'll turn to the testimony in a minute. The officer's belief that because of the situation, that eyewitness report, they needed to actually, as they termed it, put eyes on her to determine if she needed medical attention, and that they felt it would not be wise to leave the scene due to the potential danger to Tara. That's in Clerk Papers 90.
So what's your response to the argument that they waited 15 minutes for the manager to come with the key and that they could have gotten a telephonic warrant?
Regarding waiting 15 minutes, the officers at the time believed it would only be a few minutes and that it would be quick to contact the manager to get the key. This was the middle of the day, and I want to point to the testimony of Officer Corris. It's the first report of proceeding 76, thought it would be only a few minutes to get the key. And then Officer Kellum's testimony, that's in the first report of proceedings 41. He talks about the concerns for Tara's safety, that, well, they couldn't hear an assault in progress. They didn't know if she was held hostage, if she was restrained in some way, if she was not afraid or not free to speak. And the concern, as the trial court also inquired, was if they had simply forced entry, that could have escalated the danger. They were waiting, believed it would only be a few minutes. Now, sitting here, 15 minutes seems like too long, and I think that's supported by Officer Corris when he said it seemed like it took too long, but they believed that that would be the quicker route and the safer route for their own safety and for Tara's safety, and I think that's supported. That is supported by the testimony and by the trial court's findings. And I think that's, when really looking at this, it's the facts as they appear to the officers at the time, is that reasonable? And there, the officers were very clear that the potential danger, they believed it was not wise to leave the scene. At a minimum, even if they'd had the officers there waiting, it would have been telephoning, finding a judge, faxing, getting documents, and getting them back. That's at least an hour. And I think in looking at the cases that the Supreme Court analyzed in State versus Schultz, and I'm speaking of State versus Loeffler and State versus Lawson, both of those were cited in Schultz as the imminent threat of substantial injury to persons of property. And I think those cases are useful in determining how to apply that imminent threat factor, because especially in Loeffler, there that was a suspected methamphetamine lab, and the officers called in a clandestine lab team and waited 1 hour. And that's where the Court of Appeals said, no, that is too long. I think by contrast here.
Was there any evidence about how long it would take to get a warrant? And was there any argument below about the necessity to get a warrant?
Your Honor, there was argument below regarding the necessity to get the warrant. That was argued quite strenuously by defense counsel and inquired of the testimony, particularly of Officer Kellum's. And Officer Kellum's testified he did not feel he had the time to secure a warrant because of the danger to Tara. And that's in the first report of proceedings, page 43. I think it's also supported in the trial court's findings of fact in that the officer said not wise to leave the scene due to the danger to Tara. I think the officers, and this was reasonable at the time, a few minutes in the middle of the day with a woman who's just been assaulted by someone who has a history of assaulting her and perpetrating violence on her, few minutes to obtain a key versus secure it, wait, find a judge, call. I mean, that's at least an hour, and they did not feel they had that time to do so.
Where's the tipping point? No, sorry. Where's the tipping point? If you read Schultz's discussion about the exigencies of domestic violence situations, mm-hmm. and you start ticking through the factors here, existence of a prior history, a no contact order, he's been seen with her, he's been seen pulling her by the hair, seen in the, going to this other apartment. Do those alone give you, get you to the immediacy and the standards, or do you have to have something more like the failure to respond? Is that the critical factor? What is it that takes us to saying this does meet the immediacy requirements?
Your Honor, I think in this particular case, it's hard to pinpoint which one is the tipping point. I think all of them are the tipping point, because when you have that, he snatched her by the hair, pulling her into her apartment, they're fleeing together, the concern of the friend and the eyewitness. And then I think it's telling, too, that the officers, when the woman finally responded and said, who is it, the officers inquired about her well-being, and they got no response.
What if the response had been, oh, I'm fine, no worries, still immediacy, still urgent to get in the...
I think the urgency would be lessened there. I think at that point, it's clear the officers did want to physically put eyes on her, but I think the urgency would not be the same as what we have here, which is a lack of response, which, as the officer said, indicated to them that maybe she was not free to speak, maybe it's a hostage situation, and that was the need. I think Schultz addresses that it's the volatility of the domestic violence situation that can be that tipping point for that imminent threat of substantial injury, that in Schultz, if the man and the woman had not appeared and appeared uninjured to the officers, that would have been different if the man had not appeared. And I think by contrast, what we have here is two specific people, one who is presumably a threat to the other's safety and has just assaulted her, who are refusing to appear. And I think that's really the distinguishing factor that shows the immediacy. I also think that when looking at the substantial injury, it's important to note, and I don't believe there's any evidence that would be something such as the officers believe she has a broken bone or such serious injury. I think that would be a road that it would be very hard to go down. I mean, if they had just seen someone be slapped and then gone into an apartment and secreted away, I think it would be not wise for us to say to the officers, well, it was just a slap. That's not a serious concern of injury. I think the concern is definitely the escalation of the injury. And that, I felt that the United States versus Black, the Ninth Circuit case, was instructive. But also, in just a moment of my time, that the defense cannot establish prejudice here due to the ineffective assistance of counsel, and I would urge the court to affirm.
Your Honor, just to point to the record of evidence that my client was visiting Patricia and Ms. Brown came to that visit. That's found at 2 RP 137 and 145. And
is that the trial record?
That is. But this is the evidence that defense counsel had available.
Would have, because we don't look at the trial record for purposes
it's
of...
It's for standing.
It's just for standing?
This is for standing, yes.
Okay.
And 3 RP 30...
And this is just what you would have presented.
If effective counsel would have presented this, and that would have been the basis for establishing social guest standing.
And you made a comment that, well, the jury didn't believe Ms. Matthews. You know, that we don't look at that.
Understandably, but there is no finding here by the court that she was particularly credible, and
no,
I do want to point that out.
But there's no finding that she wasn't either.
Right.
So we don't take into consideration what the jury did or didn't believe.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Okay. So 2 RP 137 and?
And 3 RP 30 through 36. And just going back to the emergency aid exception, the state claims that the officers believed waiting 15 minutes was necessary for Brown's safety. There are no findings to that effect. So they had the burden of procuring that finding. They didn't. It's presumed they did not meet their burden on that. There's no evidence that it would have taken an hour to get a telephonic warrant. Again, it was their burden. They failed to show that it was impractical, and they failed to get a finding to that effect. So, again, presume that they did not meet that burden. The question of immediacy and the tipping point, Your Honor, perhaps the Matthews testimony would have been enough if there wasn't this other factor of them sitting outside for 15 minutes. These officers, if I may just finish the sentence,
sure.
These officers did not have any impetus to act immediately or to quell some imminent threat. So we ask that you reverse this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next case is Governor's